Hi everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, bringing you all the news and the views from around the media world. We are short one Esther this week, Peter, because she's in Portugal taunting us with pictures of her relaxing by a pool.
Unbelievable.
And
holidays.
In the meantime, though, I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
This week, the news is kind of dominated by our favourite former chancellor, but there are also big plans at Apple, and we want to flag up the reopening of Media. So, as I'm sure you all know, there was a shooting at the Capital Gazette paper in Maryland. It's something that's obviously affected us, and we're in awe of their ability to get the damn paper out the next day.
Yeah, absolutely. The photographs you see of people working from the scene when their colleagues have been, killed or whatever, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
So
there's that photographer who said, I went back through and I found these shots of journalists working effectively from, a parking garage.
And they're
still on the phones and they're still on the laptops getting this thing out. It's amazing. This week as well, we're going to be hearing from the New Statesman's digital editor, Jasper Jackson. They launched a paywall not too long ago, a metered paywall. And so I asked Jasper about everything from how did they approach launch, how do they work out what kind of extras would really appeal to their audience. And beyond that, we spoke more widely about what effect everybody going behind paywalls will have on the ability of the Fourth Estate to really hold power to account. So a really wide-ranging interview, and I'm really happy that we got Jasper on.
Nice.
Peter, in a bit of, I don't know, is this bittersweet news that the Evening Standard under editor George Osborne has fallen again from an operating profit to a loss of $10 million for this year? Because this is something that we've spoken about when they did their redesign, only a couple of months ago?
It's so easy to jump on the George Osborne leads Evening Standard to disaster headline on this one.
Yeah, I saw so many people making tweets about, is it time for a period of austerity at the paper, George?
That one's,
and you're right, but I think it's fair criticism because, he was held up as, the new face of the Standard. His stunt casting was supposed to, herald this kind of return to fortune. So it's kind of, it was recently profitable last year, $2.2 million operating profit in 2016. In 2015, $3.3 million operating profit. This year, £10 million loss. And they're blaming strategic investment.
I saw that. I saw that it was an investment that included strong editorial innovation under former Chancellor George Osborne. We've been saying
it's so sarcastic. I love it.
It's so hard to talk about this without it becoming skewed by former Chancellor George Osborne.
Yeah,
and I don't, for the sake of our amusement, then that's great. but to try and be slightly serious about it, for the sake of that paper and all the people that work there, it's really shit.
It is. It's awful. And it's particularly relevant now because of the Cairncross review, which is going on. So the preliminary study into the effect of, into the ongoing health of the newspaper industry has effectively found that advertising spend, excluding digital, has fallen from 70% from $4.6 billion in 2007 to an estimated $1.4 billion in 2017, as a result of which fully a quarter of all regional and local papers have closed completely in the past decade. Now, that is particularly relevant for a free sheet like the Evening Standard.
Yeah, and I think that's why we can't just blame Gorgeous George. This the same week the company formerly known as Trinity Mirror reported print ad revenue down 10% for the first half of the year. So it's not just the Standard. And I think they took some hits financially over some of the restructuring, the sales that were going on. So I don't know, maybe it's not a total representation of what's going on there. I think what was interesting, and this raises a bigger question, because the numbers that came out of that preliminary study for Cairncross are terrifying.
Yeah.
70% drop in print ad sales. It's just insane over a decade. It's nothing we didn't know, but seeing it on paper like that, not on paper, it was a PDF.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit scary.
So it's one thing to see that ongoing, print ad spend fall year on year, if you look at sort of AA walk figures, but when it's actually presented as this kind of one big lump sum, you're right, it's terrifying, particularly because I was looking at sort of half-year results for some of the big UK nationals this week. You know, they are still so dependent on that print revenue.
Do you remember we were at the media briefing and either, I think it was you working with Neil Thackeray, did this graph, which was like, it showed the tipping point for regional press.
Yeah.
I think it was actually focused on Johnson.
It was Johnson, and they also did one for Trinity as well.
And the idea was that digital revenue was never going to bring it back to profitability. It was like the data journalism equivalent of a Buster Keaton movie where he's trying to run up an escalator.
Yeah. I think what's interesting here is that the Standard has been making some quite smart plays into, you know, events. It's effectively been saying, well, you know, we are a trusted brand. People come to us because they want to know what's happening in London. Therefore, if we put on, say, an Evening Standard food festival, or we put on some sort of limited music festival, then people will pay to access that because we have the expertise there. And sure, that might be lumped under this kind of strategic investment, and it takes a long time to build that up.
Yeah, I guess this is the part where maybe George Osborne does have some smart ideas. I don't know. And I think ESI's done some interesting stuff. You know, the Independent's almost double profits. I think it's 94% up to 3.2 million or something year on year. And that's its first few years digital only. Like, so they're not totally screwed.
They're not. And I think that's really fascinating because it just goes to show you what a drag on profitability a print model is. You know, particularly if, as the Evening Standard is, it is reliant on producing a huge numbers of this paper product to reach enough people to justify the ad spend on it.
But does a digital only Evening Standard work?
No, absolutely not. Like, this, what is in there currently that isn't available elsewhere? You know, I don't think there's anything in there that is particularly exclusive to the Evening Standard, apart from a couple of leaders and a couple of columnists.
Yeah, some of the news, some of the reporting, I guess, is I was going to say unique. That's probably not true. But, you know, for me, the point is you're walking along, you're going for the train or you're going for the tube, and you pick up the Evening Standard, you read it, and you leave it on the seat to make a mess.
Yeah.
That's the business model.
Yeah, it is.
And to have people going to their phone every night to read the Evening Standard, it's just never going to happen, is it?
No, I don't think so. What I thought was kind of another thing that was interesting about this was that Amal Rajan, writing for BBC, kind of wrote up this piece, and in it he suggested that one way to cut some of these losses would be to reduce circulation. But that to me just seems to be the opposite of what a free sheet needs to be doing. I understand that you're cutting costs slightly, but you're not cutting, you know, costs in the biggest areas around print production. So to me, it just seemed to be limiting its ability to do what it needs to do to generate this ad revenue.
There is a sweet spot, I guess. What, their circulation is about 900,000.
Mm.
I just hope no one loses a job at the Standard over this. I hope they get this sorted and they do a review and it's not austerity and they do events and they do some good digital stuff and people keep their jobs and Gideon goes off and works for Black Hawk or whoever it is he's working for.
Anyway, so moving on then, I've titled this section The Great Rebundling because Apple are reportedly eyeing an Amazon Prime-like entertainment and news bundle. So the trend of the internet today has always been towards unbundling so that audiences, individual people can subscribe to a single service that they'd actually like to. That's in part why a lot of the cable broadcasters are so shit scared because it's taken away the sort of the tent poles that they can sell bundles around. And while it's worked for entertainment, it hasn't always worked for news publishers to the same extent because fewer people are willing to pay for news online. And so entertainment no longer subsidizes it to the extent that it used to. So what do you think? Is a combined entertainment and news bundle a good idea?
I'm not sure because I'm not sure people think of those things in the same way.
Mm.
I think brands are more to the fore with news and information than they are. You know, I don't, when I watch a movie or a TV show, I don't care who made it.
Yeah.
I might care who the actors are, but I don't care who made it. And I think I do care who made my news because it's about trust. So I don't know. It's two different things.
So Apple acquired Texture, which, you know, people have called the Netflix magazine a couple of months ago. And that's one of the issues we have with that, isn't it? Kind of the brand erasure. And if you pay for a subscription like that, you don't necessarily always appreciate who's actually creating it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just think there's a loyalty. There's still a loyalty. You know, the whole Trump bump, Brexit bounce thing has proved that there's a loyalty.
Yeah.
And it's almost a kind of resist aspect to it. It's like, I'm buying this because I hate all you guys. So, if you take a bundled subscription, you're not really saying that, because equally, who's going to be bundled in there is the nutcases on the other side.
You know, you're so right about that. I'm trying to think of how many of the newspaper purchases that I make are out of spite, just to basically so that my money isn't going to one of the other guys.
But I think the new European business model is based on that.
It is. It absolutely is.
I mean, it's a great paper. It's a good publication, and there's great stuff to read in there. But people buy it so that they can wave it around and say, "Fuck yeah!"
That's exactly what it is. Matt Kett, and the same for what's the one up in Scotland?
The National.
The National. It's exactly the same for that. You know, the editor of New European, Matt Kelly, has said it's a flag to be brandished. You know, sort of on the tube. It's not, it's kind of provocative. You're supposed to be reading it. You're supposed to look up at somebody who clearly voted for Brexit and scowl at them.
You know? But think about that. People used to buy, I don't know, people used to buy monocles so they could carry it around and everyone thought they were so urbane. Now we're like carrying shit around so we can start fights on the tube.
I guess we don't really know enough about how the discovery within a combined entertainment and news service would be. I think what they're going to be doing is using the money that people, you know, give them to fund this entertainment content in part to fund the news. Now, we've spoken about this. Your big thing is you don't want publishers to build houses on other people's land anymore.
Mm.
So there is still a huge issue with this. And, you know, Digiday reported that Apple are asking their news partners to produce some really high quality video, but they've not really shared that much revenue information yet.
I think Apple's Apple, they're successful in so many areas. They didn't do a great job of the newsstand, so they're going to have to sort out their discoverability aspect of it. I also think maybe I'm going to give this one to the aggregation industry for free. Maybe people should be able to choose what's in their bundle. No, so I only want my left-wing bundle, or I only want my right-wing bundle, or I only want my environmentally friendly bundle.
Yeah.
Maybe that's going to be part of this. Because I don't want to give money to... I don't want to give money to a bundle where some of it is being shared with the gun nuts or UKIP.
Your Breitbart. Or even, yeah, exactly. Or even your Canary. Yeah,
maybe. So, yeah, I think there's... I definitely think... someone's got to find a way to get past that. There's a piece, I haven't actually read it yet because it's huge, on the Membership Puzzle Project website this week.
Yeah.
And it's talking about the Netflix and the Spotify of news. And reading between the lines, they're saying that it's a difficult one because the membership aspect of that, they talk about thin and thick membership models, yeah. and the thick models are all about involvement and participation and community. Apple's never going to do that community thing, so this is definitely at the thin end of that spectrum.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Is that piece by Sherry Hugh?
Yeah.
There's a really good piece in there where she says, even if Apple did try to build kind of a community around that, it would necessarily fail because it's coming from the top down.
Yeah. I think there's a strange thing there. I think, have you seen those Facebook adverts? I mean, those are the weirdest damn thing. They're so creepy.
But the ones we're talking about on the side of bus stands, basically saying like,
not on the TV.
No.
Oh, have you not seen them?
I don't watch TV.
Oh my God. They're like, oh, we've changed. You came here for this. You came here for that. Now you need to stay for this.
That's horrifying.
It is. And the point I was going to make, other than bagging on Facebook, was they're plugging that, you know, Zuckerberg's community aspect of it. And that kind of fake corporate community of everyone happens to be in the same space is not at all what the guys at the Membership Puzzle Project are talking about.
And moving on into some more heartening news, the media careers website Mediar has begun publishing again. So it ceased publishing a while ago, ceased publishing kind of blogs and its job listings side, following the sad death of its founder, Billy Dowling Reid, from leukemia in May. I had some very limited interactions with Billy, but I always used the site when I was freelancing, and it was an enormous help for me, and I know for many other people. You know, Billy founded it in 2013 to offer advice, resources, and support to people interested in a career in the media. It had a kind of a hard rule of not featuring any unpaid internships.
Yeah, I mean, we've just been talking about community, and I think if you look at this website, the idea that it was trying to do good, it was out there trying to make things better for people. And I think the fact that it's back up again is fantastic. No unpaid internships was a hard rule. And, you know, the bottom line on that one is there shouldn't be any unpaid internships. But for someone to kind of put their money where their mouth is on that, I think was a huge thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It was such a, you know, it wasn't just Billy, it was the kind of the entire team there, all the people who wrote the blogs, all the people who, you know, managed the kind of the backroom day-to-day stuff, including Agatha, who's now sort of taking over, I guess, the kind of the brand management of it, at least, and the sort of day-to-day running of it. You know, they're beginning to post jobs again. I honestly don't know that there's a better tribute to, you know, Billy, who really did try to, who helped so many people and certainly helped me when I was looking to find work when I was freelancing, than to continue that mission and to continue to basically stand up for the beginning and the budding journalists who need a leg up.
Yep, definitely. I think even if you're not looking for a job or you don't have any jobs to post, get over and have a look at the Twitter feed, because there's some fantastic tributes to Billy. He was only 31 when he died. It's just way too young. But so many people saying how he helped, and just, it's nice that it's going again.
So this week, I'm reading Netflixonomics in The Economist. It's rare that we feature a print article here, and it's even rarer that we actually feature another podcast. This is both. It's a feature in the latest issue, and it's also a podcast that we're going to link to in the episode description. So it's a really good in-depth look at the financial considerations that go into sustaining a media behemoth like Netflix, and it's an even better look at where its future might lie.
I've been reading Instead of Abandoning Print, the 119-year-old MIT Technology Review is doubling down on it. It's on Neiman Lab. I think this is just really interesting that, you know, MIT Technology Review is rebranded. It's coming out six times a year. They say it's more like a book and provides deep dives on the how, the now, and the next of a single technology. So it's one theme per issue. Yeah, I've been thinking again for some stuff that I'm doing about the relationship between print and digital. And I think we're going to see more of these kind of complementary strategies that move away from what the MIT people are calling a collection of articles towards print products that do something different and something more. Not repurposed digital articles, but something that's got its own attitude and its own way of telling stories. Just an interesting piece.
So this week I spoke to the digital editor of The New Statesman, Jasper Jackson, who's kind enough to have me into their brand new offices, which are air conditioned, which was an absolute blessing in this heat. And, you know, they launched a Meet the Paywall very recently. And I began by asking Jasper, what were some of the considerations that went up to launching it? And as everybody goes behind these paywalls, why did The New Statesman choose to do it now?
It was something The New Statesman had been thinking about for a long time. Something that, you know, there have been various different considerations about whether it was a good idea, whether it was the right time, how it should be done. There are various arguments against sort of bringing in a paywall, obviously. Pure Reach is a wonderful drug. Digital advertising, if you do it well, cleverly, can bring in significant revenue. There's also an argument that some people would make that, you know, Pure Reach is a very good marketing tool for print sales, which it is.
So at the time of launch, Helen Lewis said that you basically can't fund quality journalism of the type that the New Statesman does purely through digital advertising. And I guess the key word there is purely.
So I'd say actually our digital ad revenue was going up. It wasn't declining. Having said that, the fact is, you know, people did believe that we could fund these kind of businesses with ever-growing digital ad revenue. And the fact is that it's become increasingly apparent over the last few years that even if digital advertising itself is going to grow, media organisations, particularly quality media organisations, aren't going to get enough of a chunk of it to make a difference, to fund, you know, actual journalists doing journalism. Certainly not with the ambitions we have. Is subscription and paywall subscription revenue a replacement for that? I wouldn't say it's a replacement. They work together. But if you look at the economics, it's so clear, you know, one subscriber is worth many thousands of digital readers, or like literally thousands of readers that you're only monetizing through digital advertising. So I think, and I am pretty certain, that subscription revenue is a better funding mechanism to provide foundations for good journalism, particularly for the kind of journalism we do.
So if you look at the stats around how much, say, the NYT or The Economist actually sells a purely digital subscription for, it is still relatively much less than the value of a print subscription. Or rather, if you actually add up the number of issues, you know, sold on the newsstand, the value of a print product is still significantly more than that. So is this, are we still dealing with the fact that a lot of publishers put their stuff online for free originally, and so people aren't, you know, the propensity isn't to pay for stuff?
I mean, that's certainly a problem. I only sort of have a 50-50, I have a very 50-50 perspective on whether it's all down to the original sin of putting stuff online for free. I think, well, more fundamentally, back before the internet, there weren't that many things you could do to keep yourself amused. certainly not in terms of consumption of things, you know, of content, of culture.
Yeah.
Once the internet emerged, you suddenly have a huge number of things. My competitors are not just other magazines or newspapers. They are Facebook, they are computer games, they are Netflix, they are podcasts, they are all of that. So starting off with that, I'm not sure that the sort of original sin of putting things on free is entirely to blame for the changing kind of propensity of what people will pay for and how much people will pay. Having said that, in terms of the New Statesman strategy, I mean, you know, we charge the same for a print subscription as we do for a digital subscription.
Yeah.
The obvious reason for that is that it's the same content. In fact, you get more if you get a digital subscription. We throw in a load of extras. We throw in, you know, early access to podcasts. We're developing our event schedule, and you'll get early access to that. You get a lot more out of the digital package than you do actually out of a print publication. Obviously, a lot of people really still love to consume media in print, and I guess all of us would ideally like people to take out both. But we don't undervalue our digital subscriptions comparatively.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's a matter of kind of bundling, in that, say, it's some ridiculous stat, like a couple of 100,000 people subscribe to the NYT, in part because of the crossword. They want the crossword. So when you're actually going about launching these kind of digital extras, early access to events, kind of early access to some of the podcasts that are coming down the pipe, how much consideration did you give to the kind of content that a digital subscriber might want?
Subscriptions are, you know, there's a lot of talk about memberships versus subscriptions, etc. And I think any sort of direct divide is between the two is actually a bit misplaced, because so much about subscriptions to media organisations, particularly when we're not talking about a daily newspaper, which might be the main source of, you know, rolling pyramid-written news stories, but particularly when it comes to magazines, is about identification and a sort of an identification with the brand. But part of that is that people have lots of different touch points with the brand. So live events, podcasts, you know, emails, etc. We have an exclusive email from Stephen Bush, who already has the very successful Morning Call, which has remained free. But also we have an exclusive one for subscribers only. And you basically want to ensure that not only are you bringing people who consume you at one of those points into all the other parts of what you're doing, but you also provide as many different places and as many different touch points with your readers and subscribers as possible, so that they really feel part of your brand to some extent, a relationship with your brand. You know, we've had people get in touch saying they can't afford a New Statesman subscription, and my response to that is, unfortunately, I can't afford to not charge for the New Statesman online, but at the same time, remaining metered rather than hard paywalled off ensures that at least people can benefit from some of the journalism we produce to some extent. And also, you know, I mean, some of the stuff we do, we will put out unmetered, as outside the paywall, because, you know, one of the key things I always said when we started this process of designing it was that you need to have sort of absolute flexibility.
So in the UK at the moment, according to the latest digital news report, only 7% of people currently pay for a digital news subscription. Mm-hmm. Now, do you expect that to rise as more places actually go behind a paywall? And what do you think is to blame for this kind of low end? They're on the low end of people who are actually willing to pay for news online, with the Nordics obviously being way up at the top.
So the answers to both those questions are linked. I am a great defender of, and I very much love and value and cherish the BBC.
Yeah.
but we have one of the most effective news gathering and publishing organisations in the world, funded by the licence fee. If you need news, you don't actually need to go anywhere else. For the record, that doesn't. I don't think we should. We should scrap the BBC like some people. In fact, I'm very unpopular with the anti-TV licensing crowd, having been a bit rude about them in print. You could argue for us, given our place in the political spectrum, the Guardian's commitment to remaining open and free is potentially an issue. For magazines like mine, I think it's a slightly different. Well, because. You know, we will occasionally break news if we've got a Westminster scoop, but generally we're not about breaking news. We're about something less commoditized, which, you know, analysis, great writing on culture, politics, you know, those kind of things, commentary. Do I think people will change? I think to some extent people will change in terms of their propensity to pay for things. I think you do get to the point where that people start to understand more, and that's, you know, why our messaging is about this, that in order to get good journalism you have to pay for it. Do I think it'll rocket up to 90% of the population take out a subscription of some kind? No.
Yeah.
But do I think that more than 7% of people will begin to pay for some sort of content subscription from the likes of New Statesman or others? Yes.
I think what's really smart about what, say, The Atlantic's doing with the masthead is that part of that does grant audiences access to, you know, journalists, editors, so they can sort of, that relationship flows both ways. Journalists can see what the public are actually really interested in. But also the public can then have this kind of one-to-one relationship that, in theory, at least strengthens, you know, their propensity to pay for, you know, their ability to re-up their subscriptions.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of model, to some extent, is something we're absolutely looking at. Mm. You know, I mean, it's early days for us, but something that, yeah, we're looking at both the, how you do it technically and how you run it. It's not a small undertaking to do that.
It's not as easy as just throwing up a Slack channel and sort of saying, well, I'm done now.
But, you know, there are ways you can do it, and that's great. While I think it's definitely something that's worth us exploring and it's worth everyone exploring, I'd put a counterpoint to that, that the problem is the kind of people who engage with you, basically you see it in comments, the kind of people who engage vocally with your content, you see it, we see it in the people who respond to us on Twitter, etc. They're great and it's wonderful, and they should have, you know, it's wonderful to talk to them and everything, but they're not the bulk of your people who actually are consuming what you produce. I think we are a long way from, you know, a truly, truly equal, one way, you know, connected nodes kind of media environment. We're not a traditional broadcast, and then forget about it kind of place, but you've got to consider that large numbers of people who are your readership, are the people you're serving, are never gonna want to talk to you.
No.
And that's fine. And the only danger is that if you really heavily invest in that kind of, you know, membership, you know, talk to us, tell us what we should be doing, that you start listening to a small subset, and that can potentially help sort of lose sight of the bigger picture of who's actually your readers and who you're meant to be writing or producing content for.
Yeah, certainly. Now, we saw, well, years ago now, that the Sun's paywall effectively didn't work as it was presented then. So are there types of organisation, New Statesman potentially being one, that will benefit from a paywall, that will actually make a real, real good go of them because of, you know, their profile and who their audience is?
So the one of the issues with the Sun's paywall, I think, is... So Sun has, as far as I remember, a comparatively low age for a big print newspaper, a youngish readership. But when I say that, comparatively young is...
I was going to say, compared to digital is...
You know, I mean, if you're below pension age as an average, then you're doing pretty damn well. Now, online... so one of the key things is that basically people who are... wealthier and thus are more likely. The Sun is very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
A digital subscription to the Sun wasn't particularly expensive, but in an environment where people's propensity to pay is less, people with less disposable income are even less likely to pay if there are so many free alternatives out there. You know, if you want something to, I'm going to use a massive cliche, but if you're a builder like wanting to read the Sun, you know, on site. I want to read a newspaper on site, you might well go for the Sun because you need a newspaper, but if you want to read something online, there are countless free options to keep you available, as I was saying earlier. So one of the Sun's problems was that it's the sort of demographic of its audience is significantly less likely to pay because they generally have lower incomes. It's a broad generalization, but it's broadly true. It's one of the reasons the Times works and the Sun didn't, and they had basically the same paywall model.
Yeah.
So in that respect, basically, people who are going for higher income groups, university educated, etc., are going to have a better time. And I also think differentiated is very, very, very key. Again, the Sun and the Mirror's online output is not very different from countless other websites. The only difference really between the two is that one's slightly more left-wing and one's slightly more right-wing. The Times, for instance, has this, you know, incredibly old, prestigious brand that it's quite hard to find something very similar to.
Mm.
Again, it's quite hard to find something very similar to the New Statesman, you know, a progressive, left-leaning current affairs magazine for the UK and globally. You have to be differentiated if you're going to get people to pay. So that's a given. And I think the people who have a strong brand, a strong differentiated brand, are the only people who are going to generally make this work.
Yeah, certainly. It seems to me as well that it's kind of indivisible from kind of that nebulous term trust, in that in these kinds of relatively low trust in the kind of quote unquote mainstream media, people are actually choosing to trust their, you know, the brands they're aware of and that they've been interacting with for longer, much more. So while trust in individual publications has increased, trust in the kind of the mainstream media as a whole has fallen.
Yes, although trust is an interesting nebulous concept. I generally am more likely to trust people whose views I agree with.
Yeah.
I may also trust some people whose views I don't agree with, but then I work in an industry which values that very explicitly, and I, you know, have a university education that kind of, you know, was very much, you have other measures of trust, but basically people trust their friends, family, and then replicating people who are like them, who have the same views. So, you know, I mean, I trust the Telegraph a lot less than the Guardian, but that doesn't necessarily mean there is some nebulous objective measure of trust.
Yeah, there's no form of trust out there. Yeah,
it's people who have managed to make their specific audience trust them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more complicated. It's much more about identification. It's much more about people whose worldview seems to be in tune with yours. Now, integrity is just spread across that, but it's much more. I mean, yeah, the US newspapers go on this so hard, and I mean, while they are phenomenal organizations in many ways, they have a bit of an ego problem to some extent, and it's actually hitting them. If you've seen recently, you know, Jill Abrahamson's been going in hard on the MIT, and other people have been criticizing the MIT and the other main sort of big, relatively liberal newspapers in the US,
yeah,
who all push this idea that they're trustworthy, that they are, you know, what's it? Truth Dies in Darkness is the wonderful one on the Washington Post. Democracy Dies in Darkness.
Yeah. It's got that alliteration to it.
But both of them missed. The young woman who beat hugely established, hugely prominent Democrat in that New York primary. None of them saw it coming. And so I think we can think a bit too much about this idea that we are somehow objectively wonderful, wonderful purveyors of truth and trustworthiness and integrity. I think you should always prioritise those as a base level of what you do.
Mm.
But it's about much more than that in terms of how you serve your readership anyway.
Then just for two final questions. You mentioned earlier that you're kind of not a fan of this explicitly hard paywall. You like the idea that people can access some of the New Statesman's journalism regardless of whether they subscribe or not. At a time when people are particularly susceptible to online misinformation, at a time when a lot of politicians have made sort of mistrust of the press a central platform which they stand.
Yeah.
Are paywalls effectively a compromise between serving a public good through actually getting journalism out there and being able to provide, you know, being able to monetize the journalism in order to provide that service in the first place?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
There is a slight danger there that people are going to be left behind.
100%. No, yeah. Like the democratic the problem is that if you restrict your journalism to people who can pay you, inevitably it means that there are people who won't get your quality journalism, and if everyone does it, then obviously
there'll be
uninformed people.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, the same thing that makes my life harder also makes me feel less guilty about it is the BBC.
Yeah. And it will be the sort of the lower end, the people who could, don't necessarily have the discretionary income to be able to spend on these products will be hit hardest.
100%. And that is a problem.
So thanks very much for listening, everybody. If you've not tuned out by this point, we have a great weekly newsletter which has links to everything we've discussed today, in addition to a quote of the week, our behind-the-scenes take on the conversation with this week's guest. And you can just hop over to our website at voices.media or to our Twitter page at MediaVoicesPod for the sign-up link.
We're so excited. We've got some really bigly news for later in the summer.
So actually big news.
The best news. Bigly news. So we're going to be travelling north to Edinburgh for the best magazine conference in the world. I kid you not, MagFest is the best magazine conference in the world. And we'll be joining people like the Shortlist's Mike Souter, Radio Times' Mark Frith, Twitter's Joanna Geary in the Scottish capital to do the very first ever Media Voices Live podcast. As a special bonus, we'll be running a podcasting workshop where you can learn from our amazing podcasting finesse. So get yourselves over to MagFest. That's magfest.co.uk and book now. It's pretty cheap, actually. I think it's only about 100 quid.
That's nothing to hear us live.
It's amazing.
And here's a thought. If everybody that listens to Media Voices shared it with just one more person, I mean, none of us are mathematicians here, but I reckon that would double our listeners overnight.
So, oh, it would.
So if you have enjoyed this week's podcast, or if you've enjoyed any of our back catalogue, please do tell people about it. We want to continue to grow and do more things like MagFest.
Yes.
So until next week, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Take care.